1230 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Clean Origin.
I'm Linda Kenyon. Now that a jury has been seated, it's time for the next phase in the hush money criminal trial of former President Trump.
Full steam ahead for the prosecution come Monday when they will call their first witness.
CBS's Robert Costa. When it comes to the jury...
The jury set to hear the case includes a teacher, an investment banker, and a corporate lawyer. The assigned foreperson is originally from Ireland. Six alternates are also on the panel in case jurors are dismissed.
That's CBS's Bradley Blackburn. It is a big day in the U.S. House, which is taking up four separate foreign aid bills.
The U.S. House is poised to approve nearly $61 billion in aid to Ukraine, along with billions to help Israel.
CBS's Scott McFarland says the Senate is poised to vote on those bills early next week. The U.N. Relief Agency's deputy director in Rafah says conditions there are getting worse.
Everything moves kind of at the pace of a donkey cart because the congestion of traffic is so bad. And what you have is people every day trying to find food, water, and now trying to find shade as the temperatures increase and we move from winter to summer.
Scott Anderson spoke ahead of what is expected to be an Israeli ground assault of Rafah. The U.S. and other nations have been trying to discourage that action. Employees at a Volkswagen factory in Chattanooga, Tennessee, have overwhelmingly voted to join the United Auto Workers Union. UAW President Sean Fain was on hand to celebrate the union victory.
Well, we've heard for years that we can't win here, you can't do this in the South, and you can.
And Fain says the vote is symptomatic of a larger sentiment among workers.
Workers are fed up in this country. They're fed up with being left behind, you know, with our win in Big Three bargaining. I think that really motivated a lot of workers to realize there's better for them.
This is an historic first test of the UAW's renewed effort to organize non-union factories after a successful confrontation with Detroit's major automakers. Today marks 25 years since two students killed 12 other teenagers and one teacher at Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado. Among those speaking at a vigil last night, former Arizona Congresswoman Gabby Giffords.
Change doesn't happen overnight, and we can't do it alone. Join me. Let's move ahead together.
Giffords was gravely injured in a mass shooting in Tucson, Arizona in 2011. It happened as she was meeting with constituents at a congressional event outside a grocery store. It could soon be pandemonium in San Francisco. China is sending the local zoo there some panda bears, and these folks are looking forward to it.
It's super exciting, honestly.
We're excited. I think it'll bring more people out here, and the zoo needs some help. I haven't seen a panda ever, if I remember, so it'll be fun.
The NBA playoffs could be fun. The first round begins today with four games, including Orlando at Cleveland and Boston against Miami. This is CBS News.
Don't pay retail for diamonds. Come to cleanorigin.com, the lab-grown diamond experts. Mention code RADIO10 for 10% off. Cleanorigin.com, online or one of our retail stores.
This is Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Federal incentives are helping pay for new renewable energy projects in Wisconsin. Here's Mike Moan with more.
Dane County is no stranger to embracing clean energy, but federal aid from policies like the Inflation Reduction Act and bipartisan infrastructure law spurring more activity. County Executive Joe Parisi says there have been past government credits for things like solar installations, but he adds the latest approach is more expansive.
Everybody, a business, a nonprofit, a church, a temple, even a government and a local government gets 30% back on renewable energy projects.
For example, a local construction company put solar arrays on several of its facilities. He says the new credits speed up the pace of reimbursements, creating more energy savings in the near future. Federal officials say demand has been strong for programs offering the aid, but Parisi says one challenge is creating broader awareness so that under-resourced areas can apply. Beyond clean energy, Parisi says the federal government's push for more made-in-America manufacturing creates opportunities for local plants and regional economies.
There's money available to help retooling to manufacture, and then there's a stronger market for those components now because they are made in America.
National polling shows Americans are greatly concerned about things like inflation, but Parisi says these long-term investments stand to help reduce operating expenses for government agencies and businesses, hopefully keeping local taxes in check while providing savings for consumers. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
More news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny, highs near 48, frosty tonight, low 30s. For Sunday, sunshine and highs in the upper 50s. Clear skies, a low of 37 for Sunday night. On Monday, some sun and clouds and a high near 62. Rain showers likely Monday night into Tuesday.
Right now, 35.
Crude and Dom.
The trial of the century has begun. Donald Trump, defendant. Tune in to the Devil's Advocates. We'll have all the opening statements and first aid testimony.
The Devil's Advocates, weekdays 4 till 6.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for Matt and Aaron.
This is Amicus, Solar Review. My name is Jim Santel. I am your host for this, our second hour on our weekend broadcast. As always, talking about the major news stories in law, in government, in the aspiration for justice in America and beyond. This weekend, spending a lot of our time in our first hour, just now concluded, talking about this precedent-setting trial going on in Manhattan, the trial courtroom of Juan Merchan, chatting about not only the selection of jurors there, who they are, some of the challenges there, but also challenges related to the administration of justice by the judge himself with respect to the defendant and the things that he is saying and doing outside of the courtroom and even inside of the courtroom. We know during the course of this week, during the course of the jury selection itself, there were some behaviors that the judge likewise noted and disapproved of. On Monday, Donald Trump was witnessed sarcastically chuckling when the judge noted that he would be in charge of sentencing should Donald Trump be convicted. And then again, when Judge Merchan said he would conduct a fair trial. On Tuesday, one day later, Judge Merchan reprimanded Trump for another interruption, another interjection in the course of the process. On this occasion, Donald Trump said something that the judge suggested appeared to be directed at one of the prospective jurors. This is going on here during the course of the selection itself. After one of the prospective juror was dismissed, Merchan quickly addressed a Trump attorney, a fellow named Todd Blanche, whose name you probably have heard a lot. Merchan noted that the prospective juror was about 12 feet from your client, sir, he said, and that Donald Trump was audibly uttering something toward them. He was audibly gesturing, speaking in the direction of the juror. I won't tolerate that, the judge said. I will not have any jurors intimidated in this courtroom. I want to make that crystal clear. Well, once again, I invoke that language from Judge Merchan just in response to Donald Trump's behavior, because it should be Judge Merchan's commission going forward this week to not only enforce that understanding of the rule of law, but also the letter, the terms, the conditions of the order that prevents him, that is Donald Trump, and prevents, once again, every other defendant out there from commenting about the witnesses and commenting about the jurors. Now, what Donald Trump can and does say, and this is completely within his right to do so, is he can talk about how he is not guilty, how the prosecution will not be able to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt. He can talk about the unfairness generally, if you will, generically. Even those things, candidly, most defense attorneys will tell you they would prefer their clients not do that. But those do not go to the specifics of individuals, the witnesses, the jurors themselves. Those things probably permitted under the relatively narrow terms of this order, but the order has been violated, according to the DA, no fewer than 7 times in recent days. The judge, Judge Juan Merchan, needs to act for the deterrent purpose of ensuring the legitimacy of this process going forward. We spend most of this hour, their second hour in our weekend broadcast, talking now about the United States Supreme Court. What's going on there? What couple of decisions made by the Supreme Court just in this past week? Things on the docket. And in that connection, before we get to that, let's do a little bit of a calendaring for the coming week at the top of this, our second hour. We know once again that on Monday, the trial resumes with opening statements in that Manhattan courtroom. The attorneys telling the members of the jury what they expect the evidence will say. These are not arguments. They're statements about plans for witness presentations. They're not to be argument. And actually, it can be objectionable. If indeed you're arguing the case from the start, it's a plan. Sometimes said it is a puzzle piece you're putting together, a roadmap, that kind of thing, telling the jury, giving more flesh to the bones, if you will, about what the judge said this case is all about. That happens on Monday morning. On that same day, another courtroom, again in the Manhattan state court trial proceedings, Attorney General Letitia James is going to be going back into court. Different case. This is the valuations case. She's going to be challenging the bond that was posted by Donald Trump to secure his appeal in that $500 million valuations judgment entered by Judge Engoron. The story there, you know well, the appeals court reduced the bond dramatically, also stripped away some basic core elements of the judgment entered by Judge Engoron. And now the attorney general going in and saying the company, the agency, the association that's coming forward with this bond, unlicensed to practice in New York, therefore the bond should be rejected. That's going on Monday. Another courtroom also in New York. Lots of activity in the judicial realm in New York City on Monday. On Tuesday, the 23rd, again, Judge Mershon going to be hearing this argument about whether or not the court order not to comment on jurors and witnesses has in fact been violated. And we look to him to see what he does to promote deterrence on Wednesday. On Wednesday, the United States Supreme Court is going to be hearing oral argument in, yes, an abortion case called Moyle. It has to do with the intersection between a state and a federal law on abortion. And in particular, a particular federal law that, as interpreted by the Biden administration, requires that in emergency situations, pregnant women who are patients, that the medical emergency staff there is obliged under appropriate circumstances to engage in emergency abortion services. Now, the state legislature has challenged that federal law, again, the federal law that's passed by the Congress itself under something they call the Idaho Defense of Life Act. This passed by the state legislature. And that Defense of Life Act establishes, according to Idaho law, that no abortions can be conducted. And the question is, which one of those holds sway? Which one of those is the most important? The determination before the Supreme Court is whether or not this Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, the EMT-ALA, that's the federal statute that, again, requires hospitals to provide necessary stabilizing treatment to pregnant women in emergencies when those circumstances arise under emergency abortion situations. Where's the conflict? And is there a conflict? There seemingly is. How do you resolve the conflict between that federal law obliging medical staff to engage in the life-saving treatment as opposed to the state law that prohibits abortions generally? That's being argued this coming Wednesday, the 24th. And yes, on Thursday, the 25th, in the United States Supreme Court, the following day, the last day of its oral argument this term, the Supreme Court's going to be entertaining this all-important immunity discussion on whether or not the chief executive, Donald Trump, in this particular case, is immune for actions, activities, behaviors in which he has engaged in the inner parameters of the circle of official duties. And of course, his allegation is that he cannot be prosecuted in federal, arguably state court as well, because he's the president of the United States of America, and the president should have immunities from any such prosecution. That is a frivolous argument. There cannot be that basis in modern jurisprudence. In historic jurisprudence, we do not have kings in America. It is a frivolous argument. Nonetheless, the Supreme Court is going to be taking it up on Thursday. Listen to that oral argument. Anticipate, hopefully, that every member of our Supreme Court is not only skeptical, but dismissive of this notion that somehow there's an omnibus broad immunity that applies to presidents. That coming up on Thursday, the 25th, in front of our United States Supreme Court. It is a busy week coming up, and we are going to talk right after our next caller about another case that was argued just this past week. That is the Fisher case. And so that issue also related to the federal interference case pending before Judge Judge Tanya Chutkan in the District of Columbia. I want to talk more about that, go into a deep dive on that, some microscopic justice, but what the Supreme Court justices said and what they didn't say. All of that in the midst of our weekend discussion that includes you. And that includes our listeners, 844-967-2789. And yes, Joe, this morning it includes you as well, calling in from Madison. Joe, glad to hear from you once again.
Thank you so much for all the information. I was particularly intrigued by the course of action that you spoke of in the last hour. If Mr. Trump continues this action of keeping putting the members of the jury, the witnesses, and the judge and his family under a threat of other people committing violence against them, and it's a very mob move, I think, to sort of suggest that these people may suffer consequences if they don't go the right way. You had suggested that one way that the judge might tackle this is first by fines, saying, you know, you cannot engage in material or actions that threaten these people. But you also suggested there was a possibility of also jailing ex-president overnight and then bring him back. I'm curious about two things on that, Jim. First off, I had heard that some had speculated that the Secret Service would never go for this because it would be too complicated. And I thought, well, geez, I don't see why it would be so complicated. And the second thing I would ask is, you had suggested that the jurors, if the judge were to say you serve overnight and then come back the next day for trial, the jurors wouldn't know what had happened. I think in some ways, wouldn't it be useful that the jurors know this? Wouldn't they feel more secure and safe knowing that their concerns about safety had been addressed and taken seriously by the judge? I'll take my answers off air, and I thank you very much for pursuing this. Thanks.
Very good. Joe, thanks so much for, again, a couple of great questions there. Let's take them in that order. And again, the advocacy from me, I recognize that rational people, other rational people out there can differ. That's what America is all about, is for deterrent purposes that, yes, indeed, Judge Juan Merchan, at least at a minimum, needs to engage in some graduated discipline here, maybe fines first, Joe, as you indicated, and then detaining the defendant overnight. That's the deterrent impact that you have upon a defendant who continues to violate the rules of the court. With respect to the trappings of that, I know nothing about it. My guess is that probably court officials have begun to think about this. Where would that happen? Plainly could not be at Rikers or some other place of general population. But the Secret Service, frankly, the orders of a court are orders of the court. And the Secret Service and others who are responsible for providing safe and secure passage and the safety and security of a former president. Yes, that's Donald Trump. They're obliged to follow the orders of the court, undeniably would probably engage with him in the trappings of that. The location of that would not be known. Other things to ensure that this does not happen in a public domain. But again, I've had many circumstances in my own career where judges order marshals and others to do things by virtue of their authority in the court. It is the order of the court, and they're obliged to do it under those circumstances. Your second question is arguably even more interesting, and that is this importance from my perspective, and I think for most jurists out there, I'm not a judge, but other practitioners out there who would say that the jury should not know about what's happening with this particular defendant coming in and out. Certainly never see the defendant himself, in this case, in shackles or being escorted, visibly escorted, into and out of the courtroom by law enforcement authorities. We are going to talk about that all-important issue as our discussion this weekend on Amicus continues. And the question, once again, is what are the upsides, the downsides of a jury knowing that? Joe indicating that there may be some interest in the jury knowing that they're safe and secure, at least the judge is doing that. I'll address that as well as our discussion here on our weekend program continues.
This is the Shaw, WAUK.
Get ready to ignite the ultimate 420 celebration at Turning Leaf in Waukesha with a smoking hot deal you can't miss. For one day only, Turning Leaf is offering a mind-blowing 40% off everything in store related to CBD. Yes, you heard that right, 40% off. Come spin the prize wheel for a chance to win some serious swag and sample anything and everything in store. Mark those calendars for 420 and take a trip down to Turning Leaf at 450 West Sunset Drive in Waukesha to take advantage of the highest deals of the year.
Do you
owe back taxes? Call Tax Solutions now and get some help. For a limited time, the IRS offers a tax forgiveness program called the Fresh Start Initiative. Our team can make it easier for you to pay back taxes, avoid tax liens, and get a fresh start.
I call Tax Solutions now, and they got the IRS off my back.
Call Tax Solutions now. 800-281-8193. 800-281-8193. 800-281-8193.
The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
281-8193.
The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
281-8193.
The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for Nightlight with Peach Wabba.
281-8193.
This is Amicus, the Law Review, and my name is Jim Santel. I am your host in this, the second hour of our weekend broadcast, and we're entertaining, as always, your questions and comments. Joe articulating this great question about the circumstances, if ever, that a jury should know following the, I'll call it the Santel recommendation this weekend, for the limited, time-limited detention of a defendant who continues to violate the rules of the court. And so what I was articulating is this notion that while the jury is in process during the course of the presentation of the evidence, the defendant is there. He is not shackled. He is not in custody. But after the jury leaves and after the proceedings are done, is in fact brought into custody and remains there overnight, access to your attorney, access to family, access to bathrooms and personal care matters, all those kinds of things. But that is the detention that is necessary to promote the deterrent impact of what the judge is trying to accomplish. And so Joe asked this very good question. Well, gee, wouldn't it be appropriate for the jury to know that the judge is doing something to address their safety and security? And the answer is yes and no. And so what the judge should do, if in fact this continues to percolate up, is deliver a very broad instruction to them. Let the jury know, and again, this would be on the record, that the judge is aware of concerns. And again, you have to be very careful about describing these things. You don't want to inflame them. You don't want to excite them or make them even more anxious that they are. But recognizing that there's a huge amount of focus, as he has already done, that there are concerns about safety and security and concerns about notoriety and publicity about this lawsuit, and that the judge is doing things that unfortunately he cannot tell them about to ensure that those interests are met. You don't want to tell the jury that this particular defendant is in detention when he is not in the courtroom. Why? Because that would tend to suggest, you don't want to influence in any way the notion that this defendant is presumed innocent until proven guilty, that he's presumed innocent throughout this process. And don't even want to suggest that somehow there is something about this defendant, his behavior, his conduct, whatever that may be, that now puts him in a detention facility. You don't want to have that information impacting, affecting, infecting, if you will, the process by which the jury assimilates and takes in all this information. And so routinely, whether it's a trial, a sentencing in federal or state court, the juries do not see that. You do not want to send them that message that for some reason this particular defendant is in custody. So it is a great comment, a great question. The jury should know that the judge is concerned about this. He's already done that, and he can do that with a cautioning and also an advisory instruction. And then, outside of the presence of the jury, as he has done, can continue to admonish the defendant and continue to admonish his attorneys to ensure that they are also following the rules of this trial. And Judge Mershon will certainly continue to do that. It is difficult to imagine that this behavior will stop and will not continue as this trial goes forward. Great questions. Also have a caller, Kristen, calling in from Waukesha. Kristen, glad to have you with me on our discussion this morning.
Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Kristen.
My question and concern is that either Trump or his attorneys, or them in collusion with each other, will purposely leak the names of the jurors in order to upset and delay or cause a mistrial or something. What would happen if they do that?
Right. That is, all these things, Kristen, you raise these possibilities. And again, begin with the notion that every lawyer is an officer of the court. And what that means is you are obliged to follow the rules, the regulations, the things that the judge has said. Part of that is that we're disclosing to you the names of these jurors, and yes, maybe even where they live and their work addresses, those kinds of things. You are under an absolute command not to disclose those. And so your hypothetical, which would be horrific, if in fact the attorneys do that, if in fact Donald Trump does that, that is contempt. And once again, you'll have another hearing on that sort of thing. And not only would the judge have some authorities to fine attorneys, arguably, once again, if you're in contempt, a criminal contempt proceeding, one of the other remedies, once again, is detention. It is putting someone, depriving them of their liberty. And from time to time, it is rare, attorneys have been jailed for failing to abide by the terms and conditions of an understanding in a trial. It is very rare, but it can happen as well. That's the deterrent impact as well, because you're an officer of the court, because then you have truly compromised the trial itself. And of course, the other part of this, which may sound somewhat less dramatic, is someone doing something that dramatic is also going to get a letter from the Office of Loyal Regulation, the bar people, saying you have now violated the rules of the court. And we're going to take a look at your bar license for doing that. That's the reason why all those folks affiliated with Donald Trump in connection with the maintenance that the 2020 election was stolen, that's why they're in so much trouble out there. All that's a remedy. That is the concern. And the judge, as this, again, if this was a few days, our concerns might be less significant. I think, Kristen, your concern about this going on for a long time and the possibility that at any time during the course of the next 4, 5, 6, 7, probably not 8 weeks, but a long period of time here, any of those things could somehow be leaked. The question then is, what do you do about that? The other concern about it, the reason why this is so important, is that with that, you may indeed have a mistrial. If you have jurors who come forward and say, you know what, I am now in fear of my life because my information has been disclosed, and you drop below that 12 threshold, which we talked about in our first hour this weekend, if you drop below that, then you've got a mistrial and you start all over again. The case is not dismissed, but that's the kind of thing, that's the dramatic consequence of misbehavior. If, as an officer of the court, the lawyers are not behaving well, admonishment, bar review, and the possibility of fines and detention for them as well. Lots of consequences, lots of things we hope doesn't happen in the course of this trial, but it is a long trail coming up in the next few weeks. Lots of evidence to be presented, and undeniably, with respect to the defendant's murmuring in court when he has with the jurors in front of the judge noting that if there are additional comments like that, as for example, the witnesses, including Stormy Daniels and Michael Cohen and others, take the stand, if Donald Trump is visibly and orally in particular saying things about them in the presence of the jury, that will prompt the judge to dismiss the jury for a few moments or maybe even an hour or so and have another hearing on that. You don't want any of that to happen in front of the jury, again, to taint their view of the defendant, to taint the process. But it does require some response by Judge Merchan. And that more than anything else is the articulated mission and articulated encouragement, if you will, from me to this court as we go forward. We are talking again in this, our second hour, about the United States Supreme Court. Again, another case pending in front of Judge Tanya Chutkan. This is the election interference case. It is pending before her, but we know it's been suspended. We know it's been suspended. Why? Because of two cases pending in front of the Supreme Court. One in particular, that is the immunity case. It's going to be argued on Thursday, the 25th. We'll see what the justices do. They need to return a decision finding that the defendant is not immune and sending that case back to her. But there is the second case involving Fisher, and that case was argued just this past week, a case involving Joseph Fisher, who did in fact engage in the riot on the grounds of the Capitol on January 6th. We're going to talk about what Mr. Fisher did, and especially what the Supreme Court said in connection with its oral argument on the legitimacy of the statute being used to prosecute Mr. Fisher, and yes, also, this is the connection, a statute also being used to prosecute Donald Trump, as Amicus, a law review, continues. As Amicus, a law
review, continues. You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK.
CBS News Brief. On Monday, there will be opening statements in the first witness in former President Trump's hush money trial. Trump watched closely as jurors were chosen, and some said serving was too much for them. CBS News legal analyst Jessica Levinson.
The jurors understand that they're weighing in on not just the facts presented to them and the law, but a historic decision.
The U.S. House votes this afternoon on four foreign aid bills for allies, including Ukraine. Democratic Maryland Representative Jim McGovern.
The world is watching. It is time for Congress to act.
A big victory for the United Auto Workers Union as employees at a Volkswagen plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee, vote overwhelmingly to join. This man was among those who voted.
I was really inspired by watching Sean Fain and the UAW and the Big Three contracts. You know, we all kind of looked, we can obviously be doing way better than this.
The UAW has been working across the nation to organize non-union factories. CBS News Brief. I'm Allison Keyes.
The Brewers escape a close call. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Brewers pitcher Freddy Peralta was covering home plate while his catcher was chasing down the baseball. Cardinals base runner Wilson Contreras crashed into Peralta trying to score. That's the last thing the Brewers pitching staff needed. Here's the play on Bally Sports.
A swing and a miss. It gets by Contreras. Freddy covering home plate. There's going to be a play, and Contreras is out. Wilson just flat out tackled Freddy Peralta at home plate. They're going to get it out at home, and that's going to end the inning.
The game went into the 10th inning in St. Louis when the Brewers' William Contreras drove in the winning run for a 2-1 win for Milwaukee. Manager Pat Murphy after the win at Busch Stadium.
Freddy and Contreras were unbelievable. William on both ends. You know, the big double and the big single. What can you say? He's clutch. Big game. 1-0 game. Just spectacular. And Contreras was, he earned his money tonight. He's going to earn a lot more. I promise you.
That's the Brewers' Pat Murphy. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny, highs near 48, frosty tonight, low 30s. For Sunday, sunshine and highs in the upper 50s. Clear skies, a low of 37 for Sunday night. On Monday, some sun and clouds and a high near 62. Rain showers likely Monday night into Tuesday.
Right now, 35.
Flood risk can change over time, and a community's flood insurance rate map shows how those risks could affect you. FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, has developed preliminary flood insurance rate maps for Washington County. FEMA also provides an appeals process for anyone with information that may change their flood hazard determination. To view maps, find a property's risk level, and details on the appeals process, please visit dnrwi.gov and search Washington County Flood Maps. This message is brought to you by the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and FEMA.
Are you and your family weather ready? I'm Terry Barr, producer of the Slice of Wisconsin series. Wisconsin weather is ever-changing, and all of us with civic media believe awareness can make a difference. Our weather-ready stories will offer the information you need. Here's meteorologist Brittany Merlot.
Are you making plans to honor Mother Earth? April 22nd is Earth Day, and it's a Wisconsin idea. Our Senator Gaylord Nelson created the day in 1970. It was his way of pushing environmental issues onto the national agenda, and many demonstrated in support. It worked. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency formed by December of that year. And today, Nelson's daughter, Tia, continues her dad's efforts. The Earth Day theme this year focuses on the use of plastics. It includes a reminder of the goal for a 60% reduction in the production of plastics by 2040. If you want to find a cleanup or education event to help during Earth Day week, or anytime, check earthday.org. I'm meteorologist Brittany Merlot.
Hey, so what's a great way to spread awareness that driving high is illegal everywhere? A catchy song, of course.
You can run, or you can't drive high. You can run, but you can't drive high.
Friendly reminder, don't drive high. If you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Earl Ingram.
Monday morning, join me as I stroll through memory lane and take in the sounds of the Motor City. It's Motown Mondays.
The Earl Ingram Show, weekday mornings 8 till 10.
This is Amicus. A lot of you. My name is Jim Santel. I am your host in this, our second hour of our weekend broadcast about things related to government, law, and the aspiration for justice in America and beyond. It has been, and it will be, a busy week for the United States Supreme Court. In addition to having entertained oral argument in a case we're now going to discuss, Supreme Court also issued two more important decisions this past week, a couple of rule of law snapshots right here. Both of them important in their particular areas. A case called Rudisell versus Donahue. Rudisell versus Donahue. Question is whether or not veterans can partake of educational benefits under two different veterans programs, the Montgomery Bill and the GI Bill. 7-2, the Supreme Court says yes, indeed. Veterans can, in fact, take benefits under both programs. It is a win for veterans. It's a win, I would argue, for all of us. Appropriate decision. Rudisell versus Donahue, 7-2, just this past week. And then another case also related to benefits and the possibility of securing an employment discrimination judgment against an employer under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. This is a case called Muldrow versus City of St. Louis, a police officer coming forward and alleging some discrimination in the context of her movement from one assignment to another. And again, without going into great detail, a 9-0 opinion just this past week from the Supreme Court, all of them unanimously saying that this particular officer and all of us now going forward under Title VII only have to show some harm from the decision, do not have to show some significant disadvantage by virtue of the employment decision that was made, kind of redefining the statute, redefining the standard under which employment discrimination cases in the federal system can go forward. Both important decisions in the area of veterans benefits and the programs that we appropriately afford our veterans, and also under Title VII, employment opportunities and opportunities also to remedy discrimination. Those two cases coming out of the Supreme Court just this past week. Also coming out of the Supreme Court, of course, not with a decision, but with oral argument on Tuesday involving a case named Fisher. Now, we know from the past, we know from the history of this case, which we have talked a lot about, and Mr. Fisher, who is one of quite literally over 1,000 defendants now being prosecuted by the D.C. U.S. Attorney's Office under the rubric of the Department of Justice. He had sent text messages to his boss, who's the police chief of North Cornwall Township in Pennsylvania, about his plans for January 6th. And Fisher had said it might get violent, he said. In another, he wrote that we should storm the Capitol and drag all the Democrats into the street and have a mob trial. Prosecutors also said during the course of this prosecution that Mr. Fisher was yelling charge before pushing through the crowd, and he entered the Capitol about 3:24 on January 6th. He used a vulgar, incendiary term to berate some police officers, crashed into a line of them, and according to the government's position on this, was forcibly removed about 4 minutes after entering. A violent encounter by any measure of the facts in this case. Now, what happens is that the D.C. U.S. Attorney's Office charges him for that conduct, charges him actually with 7 counts, a number of them, 6 of them in particular, focused upon the violent nature of that behavior. And so those counts are not the subject, centrally at least, in this case, now pending before the Supreme Court, because what Mr. Fisher says is he is charged among the other cases, among the other matters, under Section 1512 of Title 18. And yes, this gets a little wonky, but we do that here in our civics focus on our weekend broadcast. 1512 basically says this: whoever corruptly is the word that the Congress has used, the legislature has used to describe this conduct, alters, destroys, mutilates, or conceals a record, a document, or some other object with the intent to impair that object's integrity or availability for use in an official proceeding, or there's a second subsection now, it says, otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes that official proceeding or attempts to do so. Two portions of this statute under which Mr. Fisher is charged. And the prosecution says we're charging him under the second portion of that alleges an otherwise obstructive behavior, otherwise obstructing, influence, or impeding an official proceeding. And what is the focus of that? By virtue of what Mr. Fisher has done, he was obstructing, influencing, and impeding the official proceeding of the counting electoral votes, right? Nancy Pelosi and Mike Pence counting electoral votes on January 6th. That's the official proceeding. That's the rubric under which Mr. Fisher is charged. Mr. Fisher comes forward and says, no. I cannot be charged under 1512 because that's not what the statute means. He goes back and he says that this statute, and he's right about this, was passed as part of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act in the wake of the Enron scandal of many years ago, 2002. And about that time, the Congress comes back and passes legislation to prevent that kind of mismanagement of finances and of transactions, including documents. And the statute, plainly in its principal iteration here, talks about destroying, mutilating documents and records. And Mr. Fisher says, I did none of that kind of a behavior at all. This statute, he says, under the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, intended to focus on people who destroy materials. I didn't do that. And therefore, the statute is inapplicable to me. And the charge against me under this particular statute should be dismissed. And he also goes on to say that the second portion, the otherwise obstructs portion of it, is dependent upon the first portion of that statute. The two cannot be read in separate iterations. They've got to be understood together. That's the basic context in front of the United States Supreme Court that is now determining whether Mr. Fisher's case, at least with respect to this particular charge, should be upheld or not. And so what we got on Tuesday before the United States Supreme Court was oral argument about Mr. Fisher's case. And yes, arguably with respect to about 300 other people also charged among the approximately 1,200 charged altogether for violations of this particular statute. 300 of the 1,200 also find themselves on the receiving end of a Section 1512 charge. So it has a dramatic impact upon them as well, not just Mr. Fisher, but also, as we have repeated on this broadcast and repeated again this weekend, it has a dramatic impact potentially upon the prosecution of Donald Trump in the federal district court for election interference pending in front of Judge Tanya Chutkan. The case suspended once again by virtue of the immunity argument and arguably this Fisher case as well. Why? Because two of the four counts against Donald Trump also are brought under Section 1512 of Title 18 of the United States Code. Now, there are two other counts also against Donald Trump, and those are conspiracy to defraud the United States and conspiracy to interfere with constitutional rights. Both of those cases, both of those charges would survive any attack under Section 1512, and those would remain. But plainly, depending upon what the Supreme Court does in connection with Mr. Fisher's case and its interpretation of the breadth of the strength of Section 1512, what does this statute really mean? Does the government's interpretation of this otherwise engaging in obstructive activity, is that what we should focus on? Or should we focus on the documents aspect of this, in which case 1512 would not apply? Well, just this past Tuesday, we got a very good sense that the Supreme Court, yes, that's right, is probably going to side with Mr. Fisher. By my count, about seven of the nine justices looking at this case based upon their questions and comments are tremendously skeptical of what it is the government, through the Solicitor General, is advocating for. Clarence Thomas says there have been many violent protests that have interfered with proceedings. Has the government applied this provision to other protests? Sonia Sotomayor, on the other hand, took a different view of what happened on January 6th. She and Elena Kagan, probably the two who would go in the opposite direction and support the government's interpretation of Section 1512. Sonia Sotomayor says, we've never had a situation before where there's been a situation like this with people attempting to stop a proceeding violently. But the reality is that Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan are probably in the minority based upon the questions that came forward. Chief Justice John Roberts said that the so-called catch-all provision, that is the second portion of this statute, that talks about otherwise obstructing, influencing, or somehow impeding an official action, he said it's got to be read in context. Since the January 6th defendants were not accused of altering evidence, he said, the catch-all provision does not apply. That's a pretty clear articulation of his view that the government's going to lose in this particular case. It goes on. It goes on. Other justices likewise indicating their skepticism about the government's position. Neil Gorsuch asked, would a heckler in today's audience qualify? Or at the State of the Union address, would pulling a firearm before a vote qualify for 20 years in federal prison? He said, would a sit-in that disrupts a trial or access to federal courthouses, would that qualify as well? All of these questions coming out of the United States Supreme Court oral argument on Tuesday. Sam Alito allows that what happened on January 6th, he says, was a very, very serious matter. But he added that the prosecutor's theory could reach, say, protests in the Supreme Court courtroom, which have occurred from time to time. And Elizabeth Prelogar, and again, those of you who listened to me in the past know that I think the world of her. She is our U.S. Solicitor General. She is articulate. She has a command of the facts. She is compelling in her presentation, and she does an outstanding job on behalf of the people of the United States of America and the Department of Justice. She refocused the efforts of the Supreme Court to figure this out. She said on January 6th of 2021, a violent mob stormed the United States Capitol and disrupted the peaceful transition of power. She went on to say many crimes occurred that day, but in plain English, the fundamental wrong committed by many of the rioters, including this petitioner, including Mr. Fisher himself, was a deliberate attempt to stop the joint session of Congress from certifying the results of the election. That is, they obstructed Congress's work in that official proceeding. She is tracking there plainly the second portion of the statute, this catch-all provision that many members of the Supreme Court, a majority it appears, are skeptical of. Amy Coney Barrett also asked how to distinguish the attack on the Capitol from other actions that have disrupted other official proceedings. She's asked this. She said, tell me why I shouldn't be concerned about the breadth of the government's reading. And indeed, it goes on. Brett Kavanaugh asked why the other charges weren't sufficient. That is, he's charged in these six other counts. They allege some violent behaviors. And he says, why couldn't we just go ahead with those? Why aren't those six counts, he says, good enough from just the Justice Department's perspective, given that they don't have any of these hurdles? Well, again, Elizabeth Prelogar pushes back on all of this. But the takeaway from the oral argument on Tuesday is unmistakably that the Supreme Court has great doubts about the application of 1512 to the Mr. Fishers of the world. And again, not just him, but 300 others. And the major question now before the Supreme Court is how to style its response. We're going to assume for purposes of our continuing discussion here in our broadcast, the Supreme Court probably in June, we're not going to hear about this until, say, early to mid-June, maybe before that, but probably mid-June or so, the Supreme Court is going to tell us that 1512 cannot be applied. And so it will have a dramatic impact upon many of those prosecutions. It will involve revisiting those cases and determining whether or not there is a sufficient basis to continue with the convictions that were had, were a part of the judgments. In Mr. Fisher's case, again, would not prevent the further prosecution of him under those other counts that Justice Kavanaugh was talking about. So it doesn't shut all this down, but requires some revisiting of the ways in which these cases have been prosecuted. And this is the point. The point as to Donald Trump is that depending upon what the Supreme Court says about the breadth and the mission and the purpose of Section 1512, it could also have an impact upon the continuing prosecution of the case in front of Judge Tanya Chutkan. Now, significantly, very importantly, anticipating that this might happen, we know from some past comments, some past writings of his, that Jack Smith, who's the special counsel in that criminal prosecution of Donald Trump, again, in the federal court, not the state court, the federal court in the District of Columbia, that Jack Smith has already said, I've got theories. And even if the Supreme Court finds this to Mr. Fisher and others, that that second catch-all provision does not apply, does not mean that the two counts under which Donald Trump is prosecuted, those would go away. And he would argue that plainly in front of Tanya Chutkan. And all of that leads to the other consideration related to the timing of the trial before her, assuming some decisions in the immunity case and the Fisher case in June of this year. We're going to talk more about those on our weekend broadcast as Amicus, a law review, continues.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for Up North News Radio.
Most of us agree that every Wisconsinite deserves affordable health care. California mega millionaire Eric Hovde does not. Hovde said he would repeal the Affordable Care Act, quote, in its entirety. What? The Affordable Care Act protects people from insurance companies refusing coverage for pre-existing conditions and stops them from dropping your coverage if you get sick. If Eric Hovde got his way, millions of Americans could get hit with increases in their healthcare premiums of 20% or more. Millions more could lose coverage altogether. Hovde even spoke out against parents helping their kids by keeping them on their health insurance plans until they turn 26. Now, that might be okay for Eric Hovde. His businesses have raked in millions of dollars in handouts. But it doesn't cut it for hardworking Wisconsinites and our families. Call Eric Hovde at his California office, 714-730-4444. Tell him we support lower health care costs. Paid for by Better Wisconsin Together Incorporated.
The Shaw, WAUK.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel. These are final moments of our weekend broadcast, talking all about the implications of the United States Supreme Court decisions in these two remaining cases that arguably, in one case, plainly implicate Donald Trump and the prosecution there in the District of Columbia. The second one, Fisher, that we described, also arguably having an impact upon that. Let's talk about the process that would come out of a decision by the Supreme Court, say in June, that finds that 1512 is narrower in its application than what the government through the D.C. U.S. Attorney's Office or the Department of Justice has previously articulated. What would happen is that plainly the attorneys could be the prosecution, could be the defense, depending upon what the Supreme Court says, would file a motion, arguably the defense would argue file a motion, dismiss the cases, those two counts involving 1512. Jack Smith would push back on those and would maintain, no, there's nothing about the Fisher decision that would require the dismissal of those cases based upon what he has said previously. And so we would have more briefings in front of Judge Tanya Chutkan about this all-important issue, about what the impact of a Section 1512 decision coming out of the Supreme Court in June would have on his case. Does it require that she dismiss those other two counts because of the breadth of what the Supreme Court has said, or does it not? And regardless of what happens, how it is she decides that case, almost certainly the government, if they lose before her, would take that up to the Court of Appeals. If the defense loses, they would take that up to the Court of Appeals. And the point of all of that is that once again, the Fisher matter might well delay the further proceedings in front of Judge Chutkan, as matters related to the implications of a Fisher decision coming out of the Supreme Court are bandied about first at the trial court level. Judge Chutkan could rule in favor or in opposition to what the government is maintaining. Either way, likely that the case would be appealed to the Court of Appeals. They then deliberate on this, and yes, indeed, possible that Fisher could make its way, Fisher via Donald Trump, could make its way back to the Supreme Court a second time to determine whether what the Supreme Court says in June on Fisher applies to Donald Trump. That's a lot, I know. That's very wonky. That's a lot of criminal procedure here. That's a lot of procedure in court to consume. The upshot is that the implications of Tuesday's argument are that the pendency of the trial, the scheduling of that trial in front of Tanya Chutkan, thrown more in jeopardy now because the Supreme Court plainly is not going to endorse the government's view about its application and will require more argument before the trial court that also has this on its docket. A lot to consume there. We know, in addition, that Tanya Chutkan, anxious to try this case. She has previously been anxious to do so, awaiting decisions coming out of the Supreme Court in June. We will continue to watch that in June with respect to both the immunity case, which should in fact be a loss for Donald Trump, the Supreme Court saying, no, there is no such thing as immunity, as to Fisher now likely saying that the government misused Section 1512, can't be used for this particular purpose, and therefore, at least as to Mr. Fisher and maybe several hundred others, those prosecutions cannot go forward. More litigation coming up then, even when this case goes before Judge Shutkin. We know as well, she is like Judge Merchan in New York. She needs some time to try that case. She needs maybe 6, maybe 8 weeks as well. Jury selection there, presentation of evidence, opening statements, closing arguments, post-judgment arguments and motions perhaps as well. All of that takes time, probably at least 4 to 6 to 8 weeks as well. That's a large chunk of time, and she needs to identify that. She had identified that time early on, way back in March, and she was going to go ahead before all this got taken away from her and from the trial court there while this deliberation before the Supreme Court goes ahead. Increasingly unlikely as a result of all of this that this matter, the case involving election interference against Donald Trump, will be tried in this calendar year. Maybe could happen if all sorts of things fall into line, but increasingly unlikely, especially in the wake of this oral argument coming out of the Supreme Court just on Tuesday of this past week, reading those tea leaves and indicating Supreme Court is going to decide in favor of the defense in the Fisher case. And maybe, arguably, depending upon how the Supreme Court writes that case, writes that opinion, will have an impact upon Donald Trump's trial and his case as well. At a minimum, will require more litigation, maybe even appellate litigation as well. I promised at the start that we would talk more about deterrence, and we will do that. I'm going to defer our discussion about white-collar cases involving Sam Bankman-Fried and a Vietnam case until our next week's program. Lots to talk about there, also in the area of specific and general deterrence in the context of major fraud cases. But we observe this coming week, in addition to all the things going on in the trial and the appellate courts of America, we observe something else, which is the 460th birthday of a fellow named William Shakespeare. I believe he was born on April 23rd, 1564, based upon his baptism records way back then. Interestingly, we also know that he died on the same date in 1616. William Shakespeare, as you all know well, author of about 154 sonnets, 38 plays, comedies, histories, tragedies, all kinds of things. And so today, as a part of our salute to William Shakespeare and also our acknowledgement of his often frequently inviting us to think about the law, a lot of what William Shakespeare said about the law coming out of his plays. We know in Henry VI, Part 2, maybe the very most famous quote from William Shakespeare. He said, "The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers," which is often used today as a criticism of the lawyer. In fact, it's just the opposite. And so if you have friends who invoke that to convey their latest lawyer joke, tell them they've got it wrong. Neither the fact that Shakespeare was unsympathetic to the speaker, it was a fellow named Dick the Butcher in Henry VI, nor that lawyers who represent order and justice has prevented that quote from being used as one of the most popular of all Shakespearean quotes as an attack upon lawyers. In fact, what Shakespeare was saying and what Dick the Butcher wanted to do there in Henry IV, Part 2, was to overthrow government. And he said, in order to do that, what we've got to do is we've got to get rid of the lawyers, because the lawyers are the people who put order together. The lawyers are the people who ensure that the rules are followed. The lawyers are the people, some judges as well, who ensure that there is deterrence along the way. And the only way our successful rebellion will work is if we get rid of the lawyers. So that's the interpretation of that coming out of William Shakespeare. In the end, in Taming of the Shrew, the very first play written by William Shakespeare. William Shakespeare says this. He says, "Do as adversaries do in law, strive mightily, which we heard a lot about, but eat and drink as friends." Eat and drink as friends. That coming on the Taming of the Shrew. That's Tranio and Grumio, true Grumio. That in the first act, the second scene of Taming of the Shrew from William Shakespeare. We observe his 460th anniversary of his birth this coming Tuesday, and it is in that commission that I invite you back again next Saturday for more of our invitation to, as in the law, strive mightily, but also eat and drink here as friends on Amicus A Law Review. Thank you for joining me this week. Have a good week, everybody.
You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK, Waukesha's home for the Todd Allball Show.
John Mino and Jim Schmidt.
On our next show, we'll find out what's up for the week ahead with meteorologist Brittany Merlot, plus Mike Allen, a Vietnam War vet with a great story.
Mino and the Mayor, weekday mornings 6 till 9.
How was your drive to school?
Let me tell you, I had to get my iced coffee first. I just can't seem to put it down. My favorite rapper just announced a tour. My phone was buzzing like crazy. I'm so excited. I had to text all my friends right then to talk about it. Then someone started calling me and...
Let's try that again.
I turned my phone off right away. I never drive distracted.
Visit StopTextStopWrecks.org. A message brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, Project Yellow Light, and the Ad Council.
This is your hometown radio, Refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network. You're listening to The Shaw.
WAUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.